I'm Miyuki Okiranta, and this is Earshot, where we eavesdrop on life as it's lived, with its joys and devastations, the shocks and the relief. I'm bringing you documentaries with heart. This is episode 2 in our season Promise Me, where you'll hear 8 distinct stories, but they all revolve around a promise. Today, a promise lost.
Tasmanian multimillionaire and media magnate Edmund Rouse has been charged with offering a bribe to a public official. Mr. Rouse is the non-executive chairman of ENT Limited, a company which owns several television stations and the Launceston Examiner.
In 1999, 10 years after one of Australia's most notorious political and corporate scandals, a stack of exquisite watercolours of Tasmanian birds was discovered. They were found in the old Wynn television studios in the suburbs of Hobart that were once owned by the disgraced media magnate Edmund Rouse. No one remembers how they got there. The painter was Susan Lester, a young single mother from Tasmania's northwest. She was commissioned by Edmund Rouse to paint 200 Tasmanian birds for a book he passionately wanted to publish. Susan's sister, Libby Lester, a journalist and academic, wants to know what promise these paintings held for Susan, and what was their promise for one of Tasmania's most powerful men. The paintings were eventually acquired by the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery. They describe them as the most significant contemporary collection of works of Tasmanian birds. But TMAG only has 199 of the 200 paintings. The swift parrot, now one of the world's most endangered species, is missing.
We're trying to depict each bird in a typical habitat. So I've been collecting just samples of the type of tree that the bird would sit in, or the grass seeds, or whatever we think that bird would be best shown in, and just brought back samples and collected bits.
That's Sue, my sister, on ABC TV's 7:30 report in 1988. She's scratching Billy, the pet galah she'd rescued as a fledgling. My mother says it doesn't sound like Sue. She sounds young and a little nervous. But there is something else in her voice. Excitement, anticipation.
So what will it mean for you?
A lot of work. It'll be 4 years' work. Probably being published in late 1992. It's a big project, and I have about 200 illustrations to do for it.
Sue had just begun work on what she knew was the opportunity of a lifetime. The job was to paint 200 birds of Tasmania for a limited edition to be published in 1992. They were commissioned by Edmund Rouse, the chair of media company ENT, or Examiner Northern Television Limited. He wanted to commemorate the Examiner newspaper's 150th anniversary with the book. The newspaper was an influential daily that had been in Rouse's wife's family for almost 100 years. Rouse also had growing interests in television, radio, travel, a casino, and hardware in Tasmania on the mainland and in the US.
In Tasmania, it's hard to get away from Edmund Rouse.
And he was chairman of Guns, the company that would drive Tasmania's rapacious woodchip industry in following decades. In Tasmania, Edmund Rouse was best known for being unusually rich and for his tough business practices. He liked to walk around the newsroom at Christmas handing out all-day suckers to his staff. He was also known for his blunt assessment of others.
I am the founding president of the Yogi Bear School of Business Management, and you'll remember that Yogi Bear said you've got to be smarter than the average bear. And it's slightly easier to be smarter than the average bear in Tasmania than it is perhaps in Sydney.
Sue, on the other hand, was in her early 30s when the book was commissioned. She was between marriages and raising a young son alone. She was good at pretty much everything she tackled, but struggled with confidence and opportunities like many young women at the time. My parents had been living in a hut in the foothills of Tasmania's Central Plateau when Sue was born. My father worked as a surveyor for the Hydroelectric Commission on the Poatina power station. My mother says that gusts of wind off the mountains would fill their lounge room with wood smoke and lift the carpet to armrest height around their chairs. I first became aware of Sue, like only a younger sister can, when she was a teenager. She had very thick, long hair. It was dark red, like the basalt soil in our backyard in Devonport, where the family eventually settled. And she had a feistiness when crossed that made us smaller ones bolt to far corners of the house. After school, Sue had gone to Hobart to train as a radiographer, but she'd been back on the northwest coast for a decade or so by the time she was commissioned to paint the bird book. She and her son Ben lived in an old farmhouse at a place called Moriarty with Billy the Galah and Peggy the Labrador. There was also an escaped white ferret that haunted the backyard toilet and tormented me when I stayed there during uni breaks. Sue had started painting while working in a souvenir shop in the main street of Devonport. The pictures sold well in the shop. Our father, Neville, made the frames.
Her drawings became much more competent and much more detailed, and the transition was very quick. We've got some of her original ink and watercolour sketches here, and she'd be horrified to see them now, but within the space of 4 or 5 years, they had developed into very, very competent paintings, and she was asked to exhibit some eventually, and she had a very successful exhibition of about 25, 27 paintings in Launceston, and it was a complete sellout. And then, of course, culminated in the offer from Edmund Rouse, or the invitation to for her to draw the complete set called The Birds of Tasmania.
Edmund Rouse would pay Sue $400 a week for 4 years so she could work exclusively on the book. Bob Green, a well-known ornithologist in Launceston, would write the text. They expected about $50,000 each in royalties after publication. That would have bought you an entire house on the northwest coast then. Ben, Sue's son, was in primary school.
And so coming and going from school would leave Mum to be painting by herself. The time that I remember the best, she was painting owls. And so we had a couple of owls come and stay with us in our living room. So the curtains were always drawn and it was pitch black. And he'd walk into the house and a couple of eyes would be looking from the curtain rails at the top of the walls.
The story of Sue's epic endeavour attracted a lot of publicity, not only from Edmund Rouse's newspapers and television stations. Here's Sue again on the ABC.
Where do you get your birds from? The birds, for example, these ones here, come from the Queen Victoria Museum, or through Bob Green, actually. He provides the material for me, and they're freeze-dried, and although they're not in natural positions, they're very, very good for getting close feather detail and colours, etc. And sometimes the colours in the beaks and legs are a little bit different, but they're very helpful. Friends would bring up dead birds from the road, and I'd freeze them, and I used to use those as models. That was before Bob came in and helped me.
I met Edmund Rouse several times in the mid-1980s when I was a cadet journalist on The Examiner. He was a formidable figure, with a trademark smirk that his son David recalls fondly. That smile meant you couldn't help but feel that Rouse was having a private joke at your expense. In 1989, I was working for a Melbourne newspaper and was sent to Tasmania to cover the extraordinary events that were unfolding. I watched as Edmund Rouse was escorted into the Launceston police station to be charged with attempted bribery. I knew what I was witnessing would affect Sue, but I didn't realise how much. At the same time in Hobart, Labor's Michael Field was negotiating with Greens leader Bob Brown to form an alliance to oust the Liberal government of close Rouse ally Robin Gray. Rouse had tried to get a Labor MP to cross the floor to save the Gray government. Michael Field reflects on Edmund Rouse's motivations.
He was chair of Guns, which was the biggest timber company in the state. He had a personality that was arrogant, would be an understatement. He was very close to the then Premier, who was from the north, and the prospect of a Labor government with Greens supporting it, and I think he thought he could get away with it. In addition, the person who was offered the bribe was a former employee of his, and he didn't have much respect for any of his employees at all.
When Parliament resumed, Michael Field led a no-confidence motion and became Premier. Edmund Rouse was eventually sentenced to 3 years in jail. There was a royal commission that identified Robin Gray, among others, as acting improperly. The Examiner was sold, and then, in 1994, Wind Television took over ENT and its remaining assets, including Sue's paintings. At the heart of all this was Tasmania's eternal conflict over conservation versus development. It surfaced with the Lake Pedder Damming, which gave the world its first Green Party in the 1970s. The 1980s had begun with massive protests and international attention over plans to dam the Franklin River. The decade was ending with a proposal to build a pulp mill at Wesley Vale, near us on the northwest coast. We'd grown up in a home where political debate and opinions were served up with every meal. Like many Tasmanian families reliant on the resource industries for income, the stakes were high. Family fights about the environment were frequent and intense. While I'd go in, boots and all, Sue would hang back. Her focus was more on making her life and work about nature. I've often wondered why Edmund Rouse would commission a book of paintings of native Tasmanian birds to mark his newspaper's anniversary. This was a man with significant business interests in the timber industry. He was chair of Guns, the company whose name would become synonymous with native habitat destruction. Edmund Rouse died in 2002. I visit David Rouse, Edmund's youngest child, in his home in Melbourne. David worked with his father at ENT before Edmund's arrest.
Well, I think Dad, or Edmund as I used to call him, he was very passionate about a lot of nature, and I think particularly birds. I mean, if you have a look at a lot of our art here, there are birds in quite a few of them.
David shows me a chair in his elegant sitting room. It has an embroidered cover of flowers and two songbirds. Surprisingly, it was made by Edmund himself, who liked to sit at night and do needlework.
You know, it was a sort of a bit of a, push-pull for him because, yes, he does love his nature, and his time at Guns, the way they were foresting and those sorts of things, I think they felt that it was a responsible way the way they're going about it. But I'm sure deep down, I never spoke to him about it, but I'm sure deep down that there was a sort of a bit of a push-pull from the commercial side to the nature side.
David uses the word pride to describe the way his father would respond to Sue's work. I wonder what promise the book held for Edmund.
When he used to get, 4 paintings a month, I'm not sure how many would come through, but each one he was sort of, his chest would rise. You think, this is just absolutely beautiful. And he used to say to me, he said, just look at this, David, because it looks as if the birds are about to pop out of the page. They were so realistic.
So why didn't Edmund Rouse go ahead with the book? Why didn't he pursue at least some kind of publication when he was released from prison, even if not for the original purpose?
When you're going through a stressful part of a family's life, I think that probably, although we used to discuss the book, and you know, all I could do was portray the vision to the new owners. So it was really up to Wind Television at that time. It was sort of out of our hands.
There's one surviving copy of the text ornithologist Bob Green had written for the book. It was in a drawer in the spare room of Sue's house in Hobart. In notes at the back, Bob has written, "During Edmund's term in jail, I maintained contact with his son David, who subsequently informed me that Edmund was going to pick up the publication and personally publish the work." Bob's note ends, "I phoned Edmund at his home in Launceston to again inquire of progress. His reply was very brief, that the publication was not financially viable and he was abandoning it, without further explanation, acknowledgement or thanks." I think of Sue as impatient when things didn't go her way, angry when let down. But the best word to describe her emotion at this time is disappointed. A disappointment so sad, so overwhelming, it infected us all.
I think it was beyond the anger, it was the disappointment of losing the work and the recognition of the work. It came to an end very quickly, and it was fairly soul-destroying for her that that work might not be realised. And there was also some financial implications for her on that. She was fairly naive to how she was going to be rewarded for that work, and that was a stress because, again, she was a single mum and she was relying on that as a career. So I remember that fairly distinctly being a high-pressure kind of time for her. She was not really interested in the legal aspects of it, so she approached certain lawyers and people like that to try and get advice, but I think she found it too stressing and overwhelming, so she fought a few battles there and then let it sit.
Greg Smith was Sue's partner from 1995 on. Greg says that in the years they were together, Sue would have done only another 20 or so paintings. Some, including a currawong for Greg, are still in her painting folder, without legs. She always did the legs last.
I wasn't here for the initial heartbreak, but it's a hard time. It's a hard time. She got put off painting altogether for a long while, I would think. She just played around with it in my time.
After Edmund Rouse was jailed, Sue delivered the last of the paintings to David Rouse. David remembers them being stored in his father's office at the ENT headquarters in Launceston. But he doesn't recall when they were moved to the television studios in Hobart, where they were later found. Sue had no idea what had happened to the paintings. She was worried that they weren't being properly cared for. She was relieved when they eventually turned up in good condition. But the fact the Swift Parrot had disappeared gnawed at her. When I met David Rouse, I was hoping he could help me pick up the trail of the missing Swift Parrot.
You had no other association with the paintings. You never saw them again. You don't recall where they were stored or...
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
So I suspect you can't help with the next question either. So when the paintings came to TMAG, there were only 199. The Swift Parrot is missing.
Swiss Parrot?
Swift Parrot.
Oh, really?
We know it was delivered because there's a photograph of it, but the actual painting is missing, and you know, we'd love obviously to get it to try and track it down and so it could rejoin the collection.
Yeah,
but
I don't know anything about the Swiss Parrot. I'm sorry.
Sue wasn't an overtly political person, but it's difficult now to see her work as anything but a cry for conservation. Eric Verla, convener of BirdLife Tasmania, despairs over how little has been done to protect Tasmania's birds in the 35 years since Sue began work on the book.
We're now in a situation where the swift parrot is a critically endangered species. We may have as few as 300, you know, breeding birds left in the world. And, you know, the forestry operations continue. It's a business as usual approach to forestry operations and the lack of conservation, the lack of protection for swift parrots. We're seeing other species such as the wedge-tailed eagles, mast owls, and grey goshawks also endangered and also, you know, have lost their habitat as a result of forestry operations and habitat clearance. I mean, some of the loss of habitat has been from clearance for agricultural, so it's not just forestry, but fundamentally what we're seeing is a fragmentation and an overall decrease in the extent of habitat for these birds, particularly woodland birds.
Sue and Greg were at their cottage on the Central Plateau Lakes for New Year when Sue became ill. We'd all been together a couple of days earlier at our shack. Four generations and too many dogs. She was in the Royal Hobart Hospital within days. The hospital where she'd been born, where she'd trained as a radiographer, and where she'd gone back to work after the book was abandoned. Her granddaughters, red-headed like her, painted pictures for the hospital room. In the slow days and long nights that followed, it felt like we were in a mountain hut after a bushwalk. Sue asleep, then awake, quietly talking about the places she and Greg had gone in the southwest, or the incredibly cold swims we'd had in mountain lakes. We didn't talk about the book. She died at the end of January, the week she was due to retire from the hospital. Thinking about it now, I wonder how much Sue had always expected to be let down.
I'm now just about finished up with radiography. I'm doing casual work to keep my hand in. I never know what will happen when the book's finished, but I also enjoy being able to go into work occasionally, just to have a break as well and to meet people again. It's quite lonely if you're sitting here painting all the time and you don't have much contact with people, so I enjoy it from that point of view.
This is the print room, so this is where we keep all the works on paper from the TMAG collection.
Jane Stewart is Principal Curator of Art at the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery. We're in a beautiful room in what was the old customs house on Hobart's waterfront. It's just around the corner from the hospital. The walls are lined with deep shelves and drawers, some aged hue and pine. There are hundreds of handmade salander boxes, which are designed to protect works from light and insects. Early ornithologist John Gould's lithographs are here. So are sketches by the colonial naturalist Louise Rand Meredith. Sue never came here to see the paintings.
So we have here a salander box with some of Susan Lester's works. I reckon there's about 20 in this box. So I'm just going to open it up. And at the top of the box is an orange-bellied parrot, or an OBP, you know, an endangered species. So quite a topical bird to be looking at to start with. You can see Sue's really fine brushwork as she's captured the detail of the kind of tiny feathers around the face. This beautiful line of kind of vivid iridescent blue which goes over the beak and then kind of falling into this gorgeous little soft orange belly. In terms of legacy, I think the fact that Sue spent 4 years of her life dedicated to painting Tasmanian birds and learning about Tasmanian birds and painting them in such a vibrant, exquisite and faithful way is what really sets this body of work apart from other works, other images of birds from a similar time. I think that this is a really significant collection for Tasmania and therefore for the world, and particularly significant, I guess, in the current environment where habitats are endangered and we are losing some of our birds.
Jane asks if I'd like to bring the family back to the museum the next day. I found seeing the paintings together for the first time very moving. I wonder and worry how the others will find it. We carry the Solander boxes into the boardroom and spread paintings across the table.
Gee, it's incredible, isn't it, to see them?
Seeing this again, rather sad, but brings back memories.
When I was a kindergarten student, we were driving along and there'd been a bushfire. And I remember Mum stopped the car immediately, pulled over on the side of the road and jumped out and rescued this tiny little pink widget. And it grew to be Billy, who was the galah. And so this painting over here is of Billy, who I haven't seen for 30 years, I guess.
Can't believe it. One person can do all this stuff. Yes. Astounding. It's lovely. So many.
I'm also disappointed that for her that she never got to see this happen in her lifetime.
Well, it's the first time I've seen a lot of them together, and it's terribly impressive. Mm. Yeah, Jen and I, of course, just terribly proud of the fact that we produced somebody so talented.
Kind of want to ring Mum up and say that I've seen them, and that tell her that we've got them again, really.
We're now working on a different book of Sue's paintings. The design is beautiful. The museum is planning an exhibition. The swift parrot will appear in both as a ghost image, a silhouette. It will be a reminder of what the Australian environment has already lost and stands to lose. In the meantime, Sue's paintings are safe and cared for in the Solander boxes, in a room she really would have loved.
The Lost Birds of Tasmania was produced by Francis Green and Libby Lester and narrated by Libby. Our sound engineer was Matthew Crawford. And if you'd like to see some of the images of Sue's gorgeous paintings or find out more about the exhibition or the book, head to the Earshot website. And if you've got the swift parrot on your wall, let us know. Next time on Earshot, promise me you won't walk out of our restaurant, quit on our kids, run from our poverty, ignore our autism, ADHD or alopecia. If author Naomi Hart had known the marriage vows that had tripped off her tongue so easily 14 years ago would come to mean all this, would she have ever said them in the first place? Join Naomi and her husband Gregory next time on Earshot for A Promise Tested. And in the meantime, jump on the ABC Listen app and add Earshot to your favourites. Then you'll never miss an ep. I'll catch you there. Now, Earshot listeners, if you love today's story, I have a podcast recommendation for you. What the Duck is made by our friends at ABC Science, and presenter Anne Jones explores the most unusual elements of our natural world, the ones that make you go, "What the duck?" In this episode, she's looking at the science behind Aesop's fables. Jo Wimpenny is an author and zoologist who wants to redefine how we see wolves.
It's very easy when writing a story or making a film that involves some animal bad guy to go for the wolf. Like, it's one of the classic bad guys, isn't it? And simply the fact that they have managed to survive in a world that's become increasingly hostile to them, I think they really do deserve a PR overhaul.
Hear the full story on What the Duck. Find it on the ABC Listen app